I'm Mark Strassman, producer and host of BookChat.org. We're in Beverly Hills, or close to it, in the old ICM building, and we're about to talk to David Baron, who's just written Moses on Management. Welcome to BookChat.org.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and get the opportunity of speaking about my new book.
I'm not sure about the exact dates, but I somehow recall that in the 70s there was a book called Machiavelli on Management.
Yes.
And in the 80s, there was a book called Management Secrets of Attila the Hun. And now we have Moses on Management. Does this represent a kind of title shift in the kind of people that people are looking to for advice on how to manage their businesses?
Well, I think people always look for leaders to model after in terms of the way they conduct themselves and the way they lead. And I think hence the idea of using different models. I think some of it is tongue-in-cheek. I know some people accused me of being a little tongue-in-cheek about this, but I really felt as a rabbi for 25 years that Moses had a lot of powerful lessons to convey about how to lead people, inspire people, get them to perceive themselves differently. And these are very similar, as I started to read the literature of management, to the challenges that contemporary CEOs and middle managers are facing today.
Is that because the issues that managers face are really always the same?
Yeah, people are people, and getting people to give their best and contribute their best in what they do and have a vision that they share and act upon, and creating a team where people feel invested in and committed to a set of goals, I think all of that remains the same in terms of the dynamics of people and relationships with people. But also we're moving into a new age, a new era, the technology age. Some of your technical equipment is an example of that, but also what it means is that people have to make that shift, and those shifts are hard sometimes to make. And I think that Moses is a good example of someone who enabled his followers to make that shift from one way of perceiving themselves to another.
Well, maybe we can talk more a little later explicitly about leading people into cyberland and the parallel to leading people into the promised land. Do you think that it enhances or denigrates religion to use a major religious figure in his work as a metaphor for the everyday or the long-term operation of businesses?
I don't think it denigrates him at all. Quite to the contrary, I think it adds power to the message, because if people tend to compartmentalize their business lives and their religious or communal lives, and I think that's a big mistake, because the truth is we have to remain in integrity with our set of core values, whether we're sitting in our offices making important decisions, or if we're at home or on the golf course or in temple or church. So I think Moses on Management tries to get people to see that kind of values that guide us. And, you know, within the pantheon of commandments, there aren't just the Big Ten. There are many other laws that relate to measurements and scales and ethical business practices. So if anything, the Bible really does address a kind of code of conduct that one should carry with them into the part of one's life that consumes so many hours.
Well, it's not a one-to-one transition from Leviticus to the Universal Commercial Code. The fact remains that Western civilization, as we know it, in which most of this business activity is conducted, does grow out of the Bible in large part, and these regulations, and the whole idea of these regulations, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. It grows out of a moral code that speaks about not stealing and not lying and bearing false witness. You know, I'm sure the tobacco industry can take a good rap on the knuckles on that one, although in court it'll be more than just a set of painful knuckles, the results of that. But I think there are some really strong examples of kind of code of business ethics that one must be guided by in conducting their business affairs. And I think that the Bible is a rich source, not the only source, but a rich source of information to be mined on a code of conduct that one can carry with one.
Why don't we get a little cut to our hero here, and tell us in your words exactly what the state of the organization was when Moses. I don't think it was a hostile takeover, but he wasn't appointed by acclamation of the stockholders either. When he assumed the leadership of the Hebrew people, and what state they were in, what his goals for them were, and where he was coming from as a person.
Well, I'll make some analogies, too, along the way to contemporary business CEOs I interviewed and middle managers along the way as well. The first thing I try to establish about Moses was that he was a very reluctant leader. And the reality is that if you had compiled a CV for him and sent it off to Korn Ferry to try and find him a job, he never would have gotten a major leadership position. Reluctant to lead. A stutterer, prone to mountaintop vigils, smashes corporate mission statements. If anything, he was certainly flawed and certainly not desirous of this position. But the point I make there is that sometimes it's not the person you imagine to be the best leader who really brings the best qualities of leadership to the fore. One wonderful commentary about Moses was that he was a great shepherd, and even though he was reluctant to lead, that the good Lord looked and saw his compassion for sheep and said, if he's that good and compassionate with the sheep, he'll be even better with the people. And it was going to take that kind of quality to lead them. Moses certainly had, he was up against the Pharaoh, he was up against an entrenched worldview, the ancient Egyptian worldview, which, as we all know from what we marvel at in terms of Egyptian hieroglyphics and architecture and remarkable work in gold, that the Egyptians were very highly developed, but very entrenched. It was a society whose worldview valued everything that came out of the Nile River. It was a polytheistic, zoomorphic kind of worldview, but yet human life, slave life, was meaningless. 10 slaves could be crushed, it would mean nothing, whereas an animal that came out of the Nile River was worshipped. That contrasts with the Hebrew or biblical worldview, which was that the human being was the crown of creation and prized and valued above everything else. So he had a clash in worldviews against the entrenched Egyptian hierarchy led by the Pharaoh. Then he had a reluctant group of people who didn't really want to follow him, and he had to convince them that this was their destiny. So he had a doubly difficult assignment. In that sense, he was kind of like a middle manager, because he was the middleman between these two forces. And then, of course, God directing throughout. So he wasn't the chairman of the board. He was kind of following directions from on high. So in a lot of respects, Moses found himself in that unique position, and it tested his skills and abilities. And he had to be, I think, ingenious and resourceful on his own, as well as getting the message from on high. And I think that he mustered all of the talents within him, learned a few more, took some good advice, and came to achieve something very significant.
Could we talk in a non-confrontational way about the orders from on high and how readers who don't believe there is an on high are going to relate to your book and the arguments and discussions in it?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot while planning to write the book. You know, obviously, it's very easy to solve a business problem when you just say, Lord, open the earth and swallow my competitors. That's unfortunately a luxury that we don't get to take advantage of. However, in the course of acquisitions of other companies, wholesale firing of a whole set of strata of employees happens all the time. And while firing may not be exactly analogous to the earth swallowing you up, for the people who are getting fired, it probably feels that way. I think that the example of God's role in all of this, I would ascribe for you know, maybe a more cynical or less religiously inclined corporate leader to be divine providence, circumstances that occur in life, and inspiration as well, and sometimes inspired actions that kind of run against what might be the normal way of seeing things get people to take chances and risks and do things that others might not do. Bob Pittman of AOL told me when I interviewed him in Moses on Management that when he was involved in the creation of MTV, people told him he was out of his mind. I think he was inspired. In fact, the Hebrew word for crazy is meshuggah. It's kind of crept into the English lexicon. And if you look the word up in the Brown Driver Briggs Book of Biblical Etymology, you'll see that the second definition of meshuggah is inspired. So one person's crazy man is another person's inspired visionary leader. So I think if you look at that kind of divine element as being inspiration to do something that the normal course of business might not never have you look or explore, that perhaps we can look at that as kind of divine providence.
Was there a difference between the voice of God and thinking out of the box?
I think there really is. I think the voice of some higher power or authority gets you to think outside of the box and to reconsider an action you might be planning to take or plan a little differently. I think it's those kinds of leaders that are really going to be shaping business in the next century, and the ones who think outside of the box and who move quickly and who are able to be resourceful and innovative. And I think that comes from inspired thinking, and whatever the source of the inspiration, I think the end result, it comes from inspired thinking as opposed to really cookie cutter formulaic kinds of ways of proceeding.
You give the reference, but you end up agreeing that honesty, integrity, compassion, and courage are the most important characteristics for a leader. I made a very short list here that includes Lee Iacocca, Bill Gates, John Malone, Ted Turner, Jack Welch, and Rupert Murdoch, all of whom seem to have done pretty well on the basis of ambition, aggression, cunning, and ruthlessness.
You left out arrogance.
Well, that's assumed. Aren't your criteria more normative than descriptive?
Well, again, you know, I think there are certainly people who are ruthless and cunning leaders who have absolutely no compassion flowing within them, although I kind of believe it's probably there and yet to be discovered. But at the end of the day, many of these people you are describing had to find a way of cooperatively working with others or with people they took on as strategic partners. And in that process of cooperation, if they didn't learn it along the way coming up, maybe learned it at a later stage in their career. And that capacity is more in keeping with some of the themes that I talk about. And I think also, you know, people who start a company, you know, you mentioned Ted Turner, and you know, also these are people who are, I mean, Turner recently demonstrated corporate philanthropy in a big way with his major gift and challenging others to give in the same way. I think Bill Gates recently made a gift of $1 billion as well, and not that it made a huge dent in his net worth, but it's a good example of how maybe a lot of these people in their different stages of their careers come to a certain realization that getting there is not necessarily what it's all about, the way you get there. And I don't know if you talked, I talked to a lot of people at Microsoft, not Bill Gates, but a lot of people who work at Microsoft, and they told me about a cooperative spirit and how people throughout the company at every level have prospered. It hasn't been a one-sided kind of view, and yes, their competitive practices may have been called cutthroat by some, but also I think from what I am able to glean, I don't think that case has been made conclusively or without disputation.
Well, of course, there's plenty of disputation going on. The party that called them that was the U.S. government. Why don't we talk about mission statements, why they're important, and what we can learn about formulating and implementing them from Moses' example?
Well, I think for me, in the chapter I write in Moses on Management on have a good mission statement, it's never going to be as great as the Ten Commandments, but you can certainly set that as a standard or a level. You want to make sure that the mission statement reflects the values of the company, the objectives that you're pursuing, and that the mission statement also speaks about broader goals for a company as well, its role in the community, its role in community agencies, because I think the people who work with you and for you have to really feel that at the end of the day they aren't just delivering something that's going to increase corporate profits, it's also going to do something to better the world. Now, if you're in a nonprofit sector, of course you're doing that on a day-to-day basis, but if you're in you know, the manufacturing sector or some other sectors, you may not feel that, and I think it's really important to connect people with the goodwill dimension of what their companies do, because that's a very powerful way of keeping them invested and knowing that after a career with that particular company, they can look back and say, look, we accomplished something that bettered society on some level. That's another reason I wrote the book, too, because I think we have a whole generation of internet entrepreneurs coming up who really haven't been grounded in communal good works. And they really, I think, need to realize that they have a responsibility to enhance and improve the world they live in. I think some of them do, but I think that consciousness needs to be there.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I can try. A lot of what Moses did was kind of human resources development, given the fact that his if you want to carry out the metaphor, his staff of several hundred thousand former slaves were not really ready, and in fact the whole journey of 40 years was because they weren't ready to enter the Promised Land and live as free people. What can we learn from how he helped them become free that would help executives today help their staffs achieve a similar result?
Well, you know, Moses did a few things. I guess for me what he achieved was a most major paradigm shift from seeing themselves, perceiving themselves as slaves, to beginning to perceive themselves as a free people. And I think a lot of executives are faced with the challenge as companies redefine their objectives and redefine themselves, getting people to begin to see themselves in a different light. That sometimes takes years to accomplish. It doesn't happen overnight. But certainly you have to begin the process and know that it's an ongoing process. I think Moses was a good exemplar of the need to get people to redefine themselves. And in terms of pruning, you know, there was a lot of pruning going on too. I mean, let's be frank, he eliminated a lot of the opposition, and there were people who violated certain basic laws who became outside of the pale. It was pretty strong and intense, and not without mistakes and flaws on Moses' part. But I think that he set a really fine example in that regard. And it was also a process, as you point out. It took that whole generation dying off and the new generation. But there were new leaders being groomed, like Joshua and his followers, who were being groomed to assume the position of leadership, who were very strong supporters of Moses and his objectives. And one of the chapters in the book, Moses on Management, that I cite is, cultivate those who are able to inspire. The willing minority is what I call them. Cultivate the willing minority, and then you'll find among those people the inspired leaders who bring the message down to the rest of the masses. And I think that's what he did. He built a good team. We don't usually think of Moses as a team, but the truth is, if you look at the Bible carefully, he had quite a team. Team Moses was his mother, his native mother, who gave him his religious identity, his Egyptian mother, who gave him the training in the court of Pharaoh and probably many skills, his desert experience, his brother Aaron, his father-in-law Jethro. Moses had quite a team behind him, and he worked with that team to accomplish the objectives. So I think also there's a lesson in there for executives accomplishing that change in the way people perceive themselves and in the company's objectives, to building the kind of team that will help you affect that change.
In fact, there's a parallel there about the. It really wasn't so much that he converted the self-images of the slaves. He allowed the slaves to die and have their children move into the Promised Land. With, I assume Joshua was of the previous generation and so on. Thomas Kuhn, in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, makes the point that new paradigms finally take hold when the holders of the old paradigm die off and the holders of the new paradigm come into ascendancy. And I think that's also illustrated by Moses' situation and case.
Yeah, there's an intervening phase in there, though, that's very important, and that is the phase where the paradigm is being held up as something worth aspiring to, and a smaller group begins to take hold of it and to implement it. And that happens whether, and any cutting-edge change, that will be a small group who will be among the first to adopt that pattern. I think it's true of internet technology as well. It's true of other technologies where a small group immediately assumed a position of leadership there, and then eventually everyone else came on stream. They kind of were the cutting edge. They set the standard, and others followed. And I think that's important. I know Peter O'Toole discusses it in his book Leadership A to Z as well, creating the paradigm. And it may take time, but you know, these changes are occurring rapidly in our own generation, and we see them impacting every level of society, if not right away, within a few years. I read a study recently that shopping for Christmas over the internet, I think, went up tenfold within the course of a couple of years. That's astonishing. I mean, it's completely redefining the way the shopping patterns of Americans.
All kinds of people are often reevaluated from generation to generation. Everyone from Mozart to well, Moses perhaps. Do you think it's possible, and if so, maybe sort of run out the idea, if it is, that based on your book and the ideas in it, that Moses will come to be thought of as a management guru rather than a religious leader, although it was really in the 80s that management gurus had their heyday, but maybe, you know, they may have another heyday. And do you think that would be good? Do you think it's inevitable? Do you think it's possible? What kind of implications do you think it has?
Well, I think the ability to perceive Moses as both a leader and a manager, two separate sets of skills, but many people who are starting their own companies or who are involved in redefining companies are going to have to possess both sets of skills, the vision of a leader and the hands-on day-to-day management of the operations of the company. And that I think Moses had to do that. He eventually learned to delegate to the best people many of those duties. But the fact is, as you start something new, and there are so many new companies starting up, and there are so many companies, corporations redefining themselves, that both sets of skills are going to be important to master. And I think Moses will be begun to be appreciated for his ability to both have the vision and then to implement the tasks needed to accomplish realizing the vision.
Well, you're right, but I mean, my question is, what is his identity as a quote religious leader apart from his identity as a leader and manager?
Well, I think a religious leader, for me, can't be someone who simply is a distant spiritual figure who goes off and lives in a cave and studies ancient texts. I think it has to be someone who gives you a hands-on way of applying the laws that guide your life into the marketplace. And for a lot of clergy, Christian ministers who've commented on Moses on management, as well as rabbis and other religious figures, what they appreciated about it was that it starts to address a large part of their flock, their congregation, who are the business people, who they haven't historically addressed. And I think now to be able to say, let's look at this figure, Moses, who we normally aspire to be a religious icon, he had very practical advice to offer us in the way he dealt with severe challenges that we can apply to our personal and, more importantly, business lives.
Well, I can see that, and I see it everywhere I look. But what I'm asking is, if business metaphors are useful for satisfying the needs of the flocks, and if religions are run more and more like businesses, then what precisely, except that they have automatic nonprofit status, what's their distinguishing characteristic? What's their unique selling proposition apart from a self-help guru's seminar or retreat center?
Well, you know, I think there are two ways to look at this. I think, you know, on a purist's level, you can say that a religious institution is meant to advance the theology of that particular, those religious adherents. And I think that it can be extracted, and many religions have attempted to extract themselves from the day-to-day operational lives of people and interaction. But I think you also have the level on which the business of religion operates on impacting the improving of their adherents' lives in terms of their interaction with others in society and their influence on society at large. I'll give you an example of what I mean. We're going to be engaging in moral debates on a whole host of issues in the next century, one of which is cloning. And a friend of mine told me a great story about a underworld figure who was told by his friend that cloning is going to be great because it's going to enable us to grow all kinds of livers and kidneys that will be available for transplant. And then the underworld figure said in a heavy accent, yeah, but who's going to kill the clones? You're going to have a moral issue on this harvesting end of it. And I think if we can start to inform people about the moral issues, great religions will do that, and great religious leaders will make us think about those kinds of implications, that it will enhance the way we deal with a lot of the challenges to living in the next century. So to answer your question as best as I can, as best as I perceive it, the business of religion will be about informing a world that is starved for spiritual values, what some of the classical religious values are, and I think it will also still be about pursuing a state of religious ecstasy that they pursue as spiritual entities in and of themselves.
How's that different from what the Betty Ford Center does?
Well, you know what? I have a chapter in the book, in Moses on Management, entitled 0% Tolerance, 100% Compassion. And in there I talk about the experiences of different middle managers and corporate executives who deal with workers who suffer from substance abuse or alcohol abuse. And I say the way you handle a case like that is guiding with the wisdom of Moses and the traditions that come to the Judeo-Christian world from the life of Moses. You show tremendous compassion for the person suffering from that disease, but you show zero tolerance to accept their operating a vehicle that could injure others or working in the business place in a state of inebriation. You have zero tolerance for that, kind of as Moses did in a lot of the experiences described in the Bible, but you have 100% compassion for the person suffering, and you say, this job will be waiting for you. I've already enrolled you in a drug or alcohol rehab program. So how does it differ? I think the Betty Ford Center is a vehicle to help improve the lives of others. I think the guiding principles are what direct people to work with institutions like the Betty Ford Center and others to help people deal with problems they're experiencing.
Okay, why don't we end by letting you comment on what's, I wouldn't call it an inspiration, but it's maybe it's an insight that's just come to me on that ties everything together. Namely, that by creating a startup Moses or an entrepreneurial Moses or a management Moses for the millennium, what you're doing is reflecting the conversion, I guess I could use that word, of the religious enterprise into a more strictly a business enterprise, and that it does make sense then to redefine the pretty much the progenitor of Western civilization's ethical monotheism as that kind of a figure who's a distinguished business leader who deserves to be on the cover of Fortune magazine rather than anywhere else.
I'll tell you an interesting story about the cover. The cover of the book, Moses on Management, is a picture of the tablets and an executive in a suit holding the tablets. We originally tried to get a picture of Moses coming down the mountain in a suit, and the art directors all said, no matter how many times we try to draw it, he keeps looking like a hippie. So the idea is that the way Moses is perceived isn't as important, and you get this from the Bible as well, as the way what he endowed, and that's my last chapter, endowing people with a set of standards, a code of ethics to live by. If you can endow people with something that allows leaders to grow with that code, then you've really accomplished something quite significant. And I think that's the great legacy of Moses, to endow people with a code of laws that allow them to go forward leaderless or with leaders, hopefully, who are inspired. On the entrepreneurial end of it, as a rabbi who started my own temple and who began a religious institution, I realized that it was a great challenge, and you had to meet certain financial criteria to qualify as a nonprofit corporation, to pay your staff, so that the values you're trying to disseminate to others really are done effectively. People have to live and have to eat, and they have to be able to know that their basic needs are met. So all great religious institutions have to be able to answer to the bottom line and still go about their work in a direct and forthright way.
Looked at that way, obviously the next step is franchising, which the Christians did better than anyone, and here we are. So thank you very much, Rabbi David Barron, for talking to us about Moses on Management.
Thank you. It's a pleasure getting the opportunity of answering your questions.